Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Mario Ritter, Jr. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Coming up on the show, we have reports from Anna Mateo and Jill Robbins. John Russell brings us the education report. And we close with the lesson of the day. But now, here's Jill.
Countries from around the world recently agreed to provide $300 billion to support poor nations in the face of climate change. The agreement, reached on November 24th at the United Nations climate talks in Azerbaijan, left many unsatisfied. But some were hopeful that it would be a step in the right direction. The final deal says that rich countries have agreed to collectively provide at least $300 billion a year by 2035. The amount is much smaller than the $1.3 trillion that developing nations were asking for and that experts said was needed. Chandini Raina is India's negotiator at the climate talks. She told the Associated Press that the amount of money in the deal was very small. She said, "I'm sorry to say we cannot accept it." Nigeria's Kiruka Madueke, head of the National Council on Climate Change, called the deal an insult and a joke. Ani Dasgupta is head of the environmental organization World Resources Institute. Dasgupta called it an important down payment toward a safer, more equitable future. However, he added that the poorest countries are rightfully disappointed that wealthy nations did not offer more money with billions of lives at risk. The meeting went on longer than expected because of serious divisions and strong disagreements among countries. But delegations who feel more hopeful about the agreement said this deal is headed in the right direction, with hopes that more money will come in the future. Eamon Ryan, Ireland's environment minister, called the agreement a huge relief. He said, "In a time of division and war, the fact that we could get it through in these difficult circumstances is really important." The final agreement includes a call for parties to work together using all public and private sources to get closer to the $1.3 trillion per year goal by 2035. That means also pushing for large international banks to help pay the bill. And it means, hopefully, that companies and private investors will follow by spending their money toward climate action. The agreement also calls for developing countries that receive money to limit or cut the release of heat-trapping gases. Those targets are to be set early next year. They are part of the plan to keep cutting pollution with new targets every 5 years, which the world agreed to at the UN talks in Paris in 2015. The money will pay for the move away from fossil fuels toward clean energy. It will go to countries hard hit by extreme weather to prepare for floods, storms, and fires. It will also go toward improving a farming process to help them survive weather extremes. In areas hit regularly by severe storms, the money can help build stronger homes or help people move to safer places. The Philippines, for example, has been hit by 6 major storms in less than a month. Millions of people faced strong winds, rising waters, and serious damage to homes, roads and bridges, and farmland. Esther Panunia works with the Asian Farmers Association. She said many farmers had to deal with storm damage, such as trees that will not produce fruit for months or years, or animals that died. I'm Jill Robbins.
In Edmonton, Alberta, the sun had yet to come up. The temperature was more than 20 degrees below zero. In the dark and cold, Tanis Smith was ready to run up and down hundreds of stairs among the trees in the Saskatchewan River Valley. And Smith was not alone. 10 people joined her for the activity. All were wearing several layers of clothing to keep warm. "You're pretty much just putting everything you own on," said Smith, an accountant. "If you look at the pictures, you don't know who you are unless you remember what you were wearing." Since that winter, back in 2013, Smith has rarely missed a workout with a group called November Project. November Project is a network of free outdoor group exercise classes that started in Boston, Massachusetts. No matter the weather, members get out of bed before sunrise at least once a week and go outdoors for group exercise. November Project is part exercise, part fun, and part community. It is a model for exercising outdoors, especially in the winter. It started in 2011 when two friends agreed to exercise every morning for the month of November. They were looking for accountability and motivation to help them stick to an exercise routine. By the end of that first month, they had invited others to join them. Soon, their meetings were bringing in almost 40 people, and it became a year-round project. "A party is better when there's more people around. We would talk to anybody who would listen," said Boyin Mandarich. He created the project with friend Brogan Graham. Then, as people moved to other cities, they took the idea with them. So the November Project grew. Now there are 52 groups in 8 countries, including 44 in the United States and Canada. People of all ages and fitness levels join the workouts. Some groups begin with something called the bounce. They chant and jump at the same time to bring the group together. Those who feel inhibited do not have to do this. Most classes include running and body weight exercises, like squats. The project also uses the surroundings of the location. So, for example, some places include running up steps in an outdoor sports stadium. Currently, in D.C., members meet on Wednesdays to run up the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. To keep the workouts fun, they also might include fun games and activities from childhood. In Edmonton, they play snow games in winter and water games in summer. The games help to lower inhibitions. "This helps people make connections," said Jason Shaw. He is co-leader of the Indianapolis, Indiana group. Nobody is cool at November Project, he said. Shaw said groups recognize members' milestones. People can earn prizes for reaching different goals. To find out if a November Project group is near you, go to their website at november-project.com. Building community and making friends is another big part of the project, so each group is active on social media. If you do not have a November Project nearby, you can find another type of outdoor exercise group, or start your own. The November Project organizers offer a few suggestions on how to work out during colder months. Find workout friends. At the center of the project is accountability. Members promise to show up. There is a sense of letting down your teammates if you do not show up, says Mandarich, who moved to Boston from Serbia to row crew for Northeastern University. Rowing crew is a type of boat racing. Invest in some cold weather clothing. There is no such thing as bad weather, just bad clothing, said Shaw, the leader from Indianapolis. He suggests wearing clothing next to your skin that removes sweat. This will help keep you warm and dry. Avoid cotton, he warned. It keeps sweat in contact with your body and will make you colder. Also, add a top layer that protects against bad weather. On its webpage, the November Project leaders for Washington, D.C. say workouts are not canceled for weather. Promise yourself to exercise on the same days and times for a month. Create a routine. This will make it easier to stick to an exercise routine, says Mandarich. And make sure to have fun. Exercise does not have to be hard or serious. Smith, the member from Edmonton, Alberta, says she enjoys the social part of the November Project the most. She calls it a chosen family. They came together because they had fun exercising. She said, you can have fun and get fit. I'm Ana Mateo.
Many English learners can improve their pronunciation by listening carefully to native English speakers and trying to match the up and down movement of their sentences. That is the opinion of Marla Yoshida, an English as a foreign language teacher at the University of California, Irvine. Yoshida wants English learners to look for details that are important to native speakers. These details are not only sounds, she notes. Native speakers also communicate by using pauses and by saying some words more forcefully than others. As a result, native speakers might not understand an English learner even if the learner pronounces sounds correctly. Yoshida says that English learners often study pronunciation by listening and repeating something from a recording. Yoshida says that English learners need to do more than listen and repeat in order to improve their pronunciation.
I've gradually gotten really interested in pronunciation because it's something that many students have trouble with, but they don't always get a lot of really good instruction in it. They just have someone say, listen to this recording and repeat, and now aren't you better? No, you're not necessarily better. It takes more than that.
The problem with listen and repeat, says Yoshida, is that when people repeat, they are often not trying to sound like the other person.
You think that when students are repeating after the teacher or whatever, they're trying to sound exactly like that person, but they're not. The sounds that you hear go into your brain, and your brain interprets them or filters them through the sound system of your own language. And what your brain ends up understanding is not everything. It's not what the speaker intended. So you have to try to get past that filter and hear all of the details that are important to someone else. So you have to try to duplicate what the person is saying.
What details should you try to copy when you listen to an English speaker? Among others, the important details include pauses or breaths, which words to emphasize or give special attention to, and intonation, the up and down movement of your voice as you speak. English speakers, in particular, use a broad range of up and down movements in their voices. These movements can be difficult for English learners to recognize and understand. Native English speakers might have difficulty understanding English learners when learners use a narrow range of their voice. In other words, native speakers have fewer vocal restrictions when they are speaking. English learners also may use intonation patterns that are different from those in standard English. Studying how native speakers use intonation will help English learners better understand what native speakers do with their voices. If English learners want to start improving their pronunciation, Yoshida suggests that they do an activity called shadowing.
Shadowing means finding a short audio or video clip that you like that's maybe 30 seconds long, 1 minute long, at most 2 minutes long, and listen to it. Listen to it a couple of times to get the meaning and to hear where the speaker pauses and what they emphasize and what the intonation sounds like, because those are really important things too, not just the sounds. Pronunciation is much more than saying each sound correctly, because you can say each sound correctly and still sound really hard to understand. Okay, so find a short clip, listen to it, mark things that you notice, then listen a few more times just to sort of let those sounds become a part of your brain, and then start imitating. And imitate trying to sound exactly like that person.
Here is a short example of what a shadowing activity could look like. The example comes from Martha Kolln's book, Rhetorical Grammar. One of the most important aspects of your expertise with sentences is your sense of rhythm. Listen to the sentence several times. Then try to mark the intonation of the voice. Listen for emphasized words. One of the most important aspects of your expertise with sentences is your sense of rhythm. In the sentence, you can hear that some syllables are emphasized, while others are not. Overall, the voice falls after important syllables, notably at the end of the sentence. English sentences often emphasize words at the end of a sentence, the place where you usually find new information. The next time you are reading and listening to a story, try to mark the patterns of intonation that you hear. Remember, all our stories have audio, so you can print the story and do a shadowing exercise while listening to the story. Give shadowing a try and let us know how it works for you. I'm John Russell.
Welcome to the lesson of the day on the Learning English Podcast. My name is Andrew Smith.
And my name is Jill Robbins. Thanks for joining us. Today's lesson will help you learn more about the English you hear in our video series, Let's Learn English. The series shows Ana Mateo in her work and life in Washington, D.C. Here's Ana introducing herself.
Hello, my name is Ana Mateo.
In today's podcast lesson, we're going to visit a beekeeper with Ana. She learns all about how to care for bees. And we learn about conditional statements in English. Those are statements with if and a modal, such as the words will or would.
But Ana has a little problem. She is afraid of bees. As Lesson 12 of Level 2 begins, Ana is sitting with Kaveh at an outdoor cafe.
Wow. Did you know that bees are dying?
That is bad news. If all the bees died, there'd be no food. Bees are very important.
Yes, they are. Speaking of bees, one of our little friends is here now.
You know, Ana, if you ignore it, it will fly away. But if you swat it, it might sting you.
I'll ignore it. I can ignore it. See? I'm ignoring it.
Ana, are you afraid of bees?
What makes you say that?
Ana, you should call my friend Caroline. She's a beekeeper and a bee educator. If you talk to her, she'll probably help you get over your fear of bees.
I'm not afraid of bees!
Here's her card.
Kaveh gives us our first examples of conditional statements here.
You know, Ana, if you ignore it, it will fly away. But if you swat it, it might sting you.
Notice that he uses the modal will. And this is what we call a type 1 or real conditional. That is when you talk about a real event and a result that will probably happen. The form is the word if plus a present tense verb followed by will plus an infinitive.
So the real event is Ana ignoring the bee, and the result is the bee flying away. That's easy to understand. Andrew, I hope we don't worry our listeners with all the types of conditional statements in this podcast.
No, don't worry. We're not going to do that. We're only going to talk about two kinds today, type 1 and type 2.
That's good. If we go back to the beginning of the conversation, we also hear Kaveh saying,
if all the bees died, there'd be no food.
That's a type 2 conditional, isn't it, Andrew?
Yes. Type 2 conditionals can have a possible event and a result that may or may not happen, or they can talk about something that is not real or imaginary. For example, I could say, if I were president of the United States, I would live in the White House. So here is the pattern. The word if plus a past tense verb plus a modal such as would or could plus the infinitive form of the verb.
So, the bees have not died, thank goodness, but that part of the statement uses a past tense verb. Let's see if we can find some more examples and see how Ana does at the beekeeper's house.
I think I'm at the wrong address. This does not look like a place where bees are kept. Oh, sorry to bother you. I'm looking for beekeeper Caroline. I'm here to take her Learn to Love Bees class.
You're in the right place. I'm Caroline.
Oh, nice to meet you. Caroline, I thought this class used real bees and real hives.
It does. If you look in my backyard, you will see my bees. I'm a home beekeeper.
What? You live with bees? That is really amazing and at the same time really scary.
It's not scary. If you come, I'll show you.
Caroline, how many bees are in that hive?
About 30,000 in each.
Caroline uses the word scary. That means the same thing as frightening or causing fear. I think all of us have had to overcome fears at one time or another in our lives. I was also once afraid of bees, and then I learned that if I ignored them, if I did not bother them, they would not bother me. And I overcame that fear. How about you, Jill?
I was afraid to go deep underwater, but I learned how to do it the right way in my scuba class.
In the next part of the lesson, listeners, notice the way Anna and Caroline use conditional statements by listening for the word if. Anna is telling a story about why she is afraid of bees.
What? That's amazing. But aren't you afraid they're gonna come out and kill you?
Not at all, Anna. Even my children help me. Tell me, why are you afraid of bees?
I don't know. Well, when I was a little girl, my mom ran out of honey, and I really wanted honey for my pancakes. So I climbed high into a tree and hit a beehive with a stick several times. Then I reached inside with my bare hands to pull the honey out. That's when I got stung a lot. Caroline, if you hit a beehive with a stick and reach inside, you might get stung.
No, Anna, if you do those things, you will get stung.
Yes, I did.
And you know that it was your fault you got stung, don't you?
Yes, I did.
Bees know your feelings. And if you stay calm, the bees will be calm. If you're nervous, the bees will be nervous. And if bees are nervous, they may sting. So please, be calm.
I will be calm. I am calm. Okay, I'm ready. I'm ready.
Great, let's get our equipment on.
Okay, wait, I'm not ready. I'm not calm. I'm nervous. Give me 1 minute to be calm.
Be calm. That's the first step, isn't it, in overcoming our fears? I noticed that Anna uses might in one of her statements.
Caroline, if you hit a beehive with a stick and reach inside, you might get stung.
Yes, but Caroline corrected her. She is certain that bees will sting if someone hits their home with a stick.
No, Anna, if you do those things, you will get stung.
I think we should review our conditionals and give our listeners some practice now.
Good idea. I'll say a situation, then pause, and our listeners can try to complete the statement.
I'm ready, and I'll say what type it is after I finish the statement.
Okay, here's the first statement. If you go out in the rain without an umbrella,
you will get wet. Type 1.
If you feed a cat,
it will want to stay with you. Type 1.
If the sun didn't shine,
the earth would be very cold. Type 2.
And here's one more. If your car has no gas,
you won't be able to drive it. Type 1.
Good job, listeners.
Next time, we'll see what happens when Anna meets the bees at Caroline's house.
I think I can guess. If Anna stays calm, the bees will be calm too. Now, listeners, have you overcome a feeling of fear that you had when you were younger? Write to us and tell us about it at learningenglish@voanews.com.
And remember, you can also find us on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram. I'm Jill Robbins.
And I'm Andrew Smith.
And that's our show for today. But join us again tomorrow. to keep learning English on the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver.